Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and our Groovy Thursday Open Forum continues. Open Forum means if you have a question about Catholic thinking, about Catholic teaching, about Catholic sacraments or life, or about the Bible, about what we believe and what we do as Catholics, today is your day.
In other words, Catholic stuff.
Catholic stuff, yeah. You can sum it all up under Catholic stuff.
Yeah.
And that is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And he will be taking your questions today. Again, the number 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. How do you feel about calls from people who are not Catholic, though, Jimmy?
Totally fine.
You feel totally fine about that? So let's, you know, if you're not a Catholic and you've always had a question about the Catholic faith or even something about the Catholic faith challenges you, give us a call, 888-318-7884. We'll be happy to take that call. I have to say, Jimmy, the lines are 100% full at the moment. So, I really like your shirt. That's very cosmic. You have a cosmic shirt on. I just realized.
What a radio thing to
do.
Right.
Point out someone's clothes on the radio.
Yeah.
Well, I can do a theater of the mind. Jimmy is wearing a shirt that looks very much like it's possibly a NASA picture of some very colorful part of the universe. Yeah.
So it's got like blue and pink and stars and space black background and all that. I think it is a photograph of some nebula, but I don't know which one.
It's kind of nebulous.
In my mind anyway.
And it's new? You haven't?
I've had it for a while, but I haven't worn it here before.
Yep. And just to complete the picture, Jimmy's also wearing his what do we call it? Not traditional, but accustomed white.
Characteristic
white denim jacket and red flowing mane and beard. How was that?
Nope, pretty good.
Boy, that's right.
So, and if you're not seeing that right now, then you can just by going to Facebook or YouTube and Periscope and watching our live stream.
That's right. And I'll try to get some questions from Facebook or YouTube if I can today. 888-318-7884, the number if you want to call. And Jimmy, I think I will go straight to Anna in Fort Worth, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Anna, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. On Wednesday, the reading in the Mass was from the Gospel of Mark. It was chapter 4, verses 1 through 20. And I don't have the exact the number on the verse that I had a question about, but it reads, the mystery of the kingdom of God has been granted to you, but to those outside, everything comes in parables, so that, and this is the part I have a question about, they may look and see but not perceive, and hear and listen but not understand, in order that they may not be converted and be forgiven. So can you explain to me what the Lord meant by that?
Yeah, so this is one of the most mysterious passages in the Gospels, and there are parallels to it elsewhere, such as in Matthew. If you look in Matthew chapter 13, which is basically an expanded version of the parables in Mark 4, he says something like this, you know, in the different Gospels, and partly what he's doing is quoting from the prophet Isaiah. Because Isaiah said something very similar about this is a people that whose heart has grown fat and they've gotten sluggish and they're not listening and things like that. I mean, it's basically a reiteration and amplification of a sentiment that was already expressed. And exactly what he means is something that scholars have debated. One of the most helpful ways that I found to look at it is something that is proposed by Pope Benedict XVI. If you read his Jesus of Nazareth series, Volume 1, he has a section where he discusses the parables of Jesus, and he talks at some length about this saying, which kind of, you know, explains Jesus's whole approach of using parables and then explaining them privately to the disciples. Basically, the way Pope Benedict looked at it was to say that, you know, it is somewhat mysterious, but Jesus has come for a specific reason. He's come not just to proclaim God's word. If that was his only mission, he might do it in a very straightforward way to make it really clear to everybody. But he's also come to die for us. And he's conscious of the fact that he is eventually going to go to the cross. And that means that he's, as part of God's plan of the ages, going to be submitting himself to the hands of people who are opposing God's plan. And for those people, at least, he's not going out of his way to help them figure things out because their hearts are fundamentally wrong. They're opposing God, and he is willing to speak in a somewhat obscure manner so that those who don't want to understand the mysteries of the kingdom aren't confronted with them and will go ahead and fulfill their part of God's plan by crucifying the Messiah. So that's at least one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is the fact that God often speaks to us in a somewhat mysterious way. Partly, that's so that we learn our lesson better. If you ever notice, like in math class, when you would be working on a problem, the teacher would always want you to show your work, right? Mm-hmm. Not just put down the answer. You need to show your work. And the reason for that is to show that you have internalized the thought process rather than of how you solve the math problem, rather than just being able to guess the answer or something like that. And the reason they want you to do that is so that you're forced to internalize the thought process of here's how you solve this type of math problem. If the teacher just said, well, here's the principle, and didn't make you do any problems using the principle,
right,
you wouldn't learn it as well. And so when we have to struggle through something to figure it out, we end up learning it better. And that's one of the reasons that God seems to speak to us in a sometimes elliptical or symbolic or even mysterious way, so that we're forced to think through what he has said carefully, and so we end up learning it better. Now, that would apply in the case of Jesus's ministry to those who want to understand the mysteries of the kingdom of God and who have hearts that are open to Jesus's teaching. So if you're – now, of course, the disciples themselves, the 12 apostles, they need to be teachers, so they get it all explained to them. But if you're just an ordinary person hearing Jesus's parables, if you have a clue or two about what he means, like when he's talking about the kingdom or a king or something, then you can kind of figure out what the rest of the parable means. And so he was communicating information for those who had ears to hear, who were willing to think it through. But if you are someone who's fundamentally closed to his message, if you don't have ears to hear, then he's not going out of his way to help you out because borrowing from Isaiah, this people's heart has grown fat and they've gotten sluggish and their eyes have closed and they're not listening to God anymore. And so they're going to fulfill their part in God's plan in a different way.
Okay, Anna?
That's great. Can you tell me where I can find what Pope Benedict wrote about this?
Yeah, it's in Volume 1 of his series Jesus of Nazareth. So Jesus of Nazareth, Volume 1. He has a chapter on the miracle, on the parables of Christ.
Thank you very much, Anna, for that call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we'll get to your questions and Jimmy's answers right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and his DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 each. That's a savings of over 70%. Both the book and the DVD were made specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue, and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of the book, Persuasive Pro-Life, or the DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5 each, just call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest today, and our topic is whatever is on your mind about the Catholic faith. It's open forum, and we're happy to take whatever call you might have with your questions about the Catholic faith. We go now to Artie in Arizona, watching on Facebook. Thanks for joining us on Facebook. Artie, your question for Jimmy.
Hello. Hi, Sai and Jimmy. It's so great to be on the air.
I think I usually mispronounce your name, Artie, because I see you there on Facebook sometimes. I didn't know it was I thought it was pronounced Arthy, I think.
That's right. That's actually how it's pronounced.
Oh, that is how it's pronounced.
Arthy, yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, got you. Okay. Your question for Jimmy?
Yeah, Arthy is a Hindi name, right?
Yeah, it's an Indian name.
Oh, namaste.
Right back at you.
Well done, Artie.
So, my question for Jimmy is, I've been reading. I've been hearing a lot of, we come across a lot of Muslims, and so I wanted to know the Catholic defense to the claim in Islam that Jesus is only a prophet because he never claimed to be God or equal to God in the Gospels, and it's not written anywhere in the Gospels that Jesus said that he is God. So, maybe it's staring at me, right? You know, it's right there, but I can't seem to find where Jesus says that he is God.
Mm-hmm. So he doesn't use that language. There are places where the inspired writer does say that, notably in John chapter 1, for example. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then it goes on to identify Jesus as the Word made flesh. So we do have the inspired authors of Scripture doing that. St. Paul does it too in his epistles. But if they're not going to listen to that, then there are places where Jesus addresses this. One of them is the fact that he refers to himself as the Son of God. Because if you have – in the case of a human being, if you have a father – and he has a son, then the son, although maybe younger, maybe subordinate to the father in some ways, nevertheless has the same human nature as the father. So the father has a human nature, the son has a human nature, and therefore the father and the son are equal in their nature. And so with Jesus as the pre-existing, because he says, you know, he's come down from heaven, he does, and there are other things that indicate this as well, but he indicates he's come down from heaven and he's been born of a virgin with no human father, which underscores the fact that God is his father in a special way. So if God is his father, then he and God share the same nature, just like a human father and a human son share the same nature. So the divine father and the divine son both share a divine nature and are equal in that sense. So that's one way of showing that Jesus is God. There's an even more direct way, though. In John's gospel in particular, there are a couple of instances. One of them is at the end of John chapter 8, where Jesus uses a very interesting expression. And this comes up a couple of times in John. On one occasion, he's asked, he's talking about Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And they're saying, well, what do you know about Abraham? You're not even 50 years old. And he says, before Abraham was, I am. And this means a couple of things. Number one, it means he's a pre-existent being who's been around for thousands of years, because Abraham lived like 2,000 years before Christ. But also, he is directly claiming to be God, because he uses the phrase I am in Greek. That's ego emi. And it is the phrase that is used for God's name in Exodus in the Septuagint Greek translation of the Old Testament. So Jesus is directly claiming to be the God I am. And it's not only obvious to us that he means that, it's obvious to his audience at the time, because his opponents in the crowd then pick up stones to stone him, because they've realized correctly that he is he's claiming to be divine, and so they think he's blaspheming by claiming to be God. So he points it out there. There are also some other places, like when he appears before the high priest and he gets sentenced to be crucified because of some of the things he claims. Some of those actually involve claims to be divine as well. But some of the particularly clear ones are in John, like in John 8:58, where he says that where he uses the divine name I am in reference to himself.
Okay, Arthi?
That was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that call. Again, 888-318-7884 is our number. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, we're happy to take it today. You do not have to be Catholic to call. 888-318-7884. Christina in Worcester, Mass, listening on Emmanuel Radio. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Christina, your question.
Hey, Jimmy. Good evening. Both of you, actually. I'm wondering, how many actual archangels are there that the Catholic Church recognizes? I know that Michael, Raphael, and Gabriel are the main three. I'm just wondering how many others are recognized by the Catholic Church. I've heard 7, I've heard 14. Jimmy, how many actual archangels do we recognize in the Catholic Church?
There's no church teaching on this. In fact, the number of archangels, like the number of angels, is something we don't really know. In Scripture, we're told that there are myriads of angels, which would mean hundreds of millions. And so it's just an innumerably vast multitude. We really don't know the number of angels. And then within that broad category of angels, there are certain different types of angels, like cherubim and seraphim. And then in a couple of passages in the New Testament, we have references to an archangel. This is it's just a Greek word, archangelos, which just means high-ranking angel. Arche is a Greek word that means chief or first, and it's used to indicate someone who's high-ranking. Like an archpriest is just a high-ranking priest, and an archangel is just a high-ranking angel. So like in the army, you could have a bunch of different ranks. And if you're someone's like a general or an admiral or something like that, well, then that's a high-ranking person. But there can be other high-ranking officers too, like majors and captains. But then you have other ranks, like non-commissioned officers, like privates and sergeants, and they're low-ranking. Well, God's heavenly hierarchy is modeled off of a king's court, which would include various officials who do things, and there would be some high-ranking officials. But really what the term archangel tells us is that this is just a high-ranking angel, but it doesn't specify which high rank the angel has. That's something that in this life we're not privy to. In terms of how this concept has been received in Catholic tradition, and this is lower T tradition, it's not upper T tradition. It's not something that's binding. It's just what people have done with this concept. There are people who have talked in terms of there being seven archangels. That's based, among other things, on the Book of Revelation's discussion of there being seven spirits of God, and in the Book of Tobit, you have a reference, if I'm not mistaken, to there being seven angels who always stand in God's presence, and Raphael is one of those. The three that you mentioned, Michael, Raphael, and Gabriel, have all been called archangels simply because they're the three whose names we know. We're not told the names in Scripture in the Catholic canon of any other angels. If you go into apocryphal literature, there's lots of names for angels. But in terms of what you find in the Catholic Bible, only three have names. And one of them, Michael, is called an archangel. So we can be confident that he's an archangel. But the term has been extended to Gabriel and Raphael because they're prominent enough that they get mentioned in Scripture, and Gabriel gets to do really important things like announce the birth of the Messiah. So people have kind of figured, well, let's consider them archangels too. But that's not a matter of church teaching. That's just a matter of how the lowercase t tradition has developed.
Okay. Thank you very much for that question. Is it significant at all that Christina, I meant to say thank you to you personally. Is it significant at all that all the angel names we have end with the letters EL?
Oh, yeah. And I bet you know why.
I think L means either God or – It means God.
L is one of the names for God. So Michael means God – means who is like God.
Uh-huh.
And Raphael – means God heals, and Gabriel means something like God is my mighty man, God is my hero, something like that.
Ah, so
God is my mighty one.
Yeah. So that gives us a sense that it's just connecting them to God.
This was actually common. It wasn't just angels who had this name or had this as part of their name. And it wasn't just in Israel that this happened. This is what's known as a theophoric element in a name.
Oh.
Theophoric elements are where in a given culture they use the name of God or one of the gods when they're naming their children. And you see this all the time in Israel. They would do this. So like Elijah is Eliyahu. My God is Yahweh.
I see.
Anytime you see an E-L on the end of a name or the front, like Eli,
mm-hmm.
just means my God. Or Daniel, God is my judge. Anytime you see an L or an Aya in a name, it's a reference to God or Yahweh. You also see the same thing in other cultures, though. And this is one way that anthropologists and archaeologists figure out who these people were worshiping and who the popular deities of the time were. So like in Egypt, the great pharaoh Ramesses, Ra has drawn out.
Okay.
Or Amenhotep. Hotep means is pleased. And so Amenhotep means Amun, the god Amun, is pleased. And so forth.
Yeah. So if our society kind of continues on the path it's going with its deifying of certain things, pretty soon our children will be named after our sports teams probably.
Celebrity pop idols or something.
Right. Yeah. My God is the Green Bay Packers or something. Yeah. It will be the
Brittany is pleased.
Let's see if we can get another question before we have to go to a break. Jeff in Las Vegas listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. We may have to get the question and then do the answer after, but we'll give it a try. Jeff, your question for Jimmy.
Okay, I know the program well. I know the Bible pretty well myself, but this is what I would ask is, I don't think there's good evidence for the resurrection, and the reason I say that is because if you look at the accounts in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in which Matthew and Luke take their evidence from Mark, who's the oldest account in that case, that I'm just reading now. I got the accounts, the Synoptic Gospels pulled up on my phone, and when the women came, I'll just read this one. When the women, verse 8, the women were trembled, went out and fled the tomb, and they said nothing to anybody. The account in Matthew says they went and hurried back to the disciples and told them everything.
Mm-hmm.
That is a straight contradiction. Now, what my main question is besides the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, there's no outside Christian, non-Christian evidence to prove that Jesus ever, that he resurrected. You would have to take this account by faith, and all Catholics, all Christians, most of the time like I did, took this account by faith, and we didn't check the evidence out. She says,
okay. Jeff, I'm sorry to have to interrupt you, but we're just heading out to a hard break. So the question has to do with the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. We'll get to that when we come back. So hang on, Jeff. We'll be right back with more. Jimmy Akin and your questions. Open forum on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed the list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answer's brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Listeners to Catholic Radio, I think, benefit most, at least initially, from what I call remedial catechesis. What Catholic Radio does is it becomes an echo chamber for the teaching authority of the Catholic Church. And what we're doing is teaching many things which have been neglected over the last 40, 50 years. If you listen to Catholic Radio, you know what the Catholic Church teaches.
Al Cresta thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Groovy Music Thursday. Jim Akin, our guest, all is right in the world. But Jeff in Las Vegas wants to know about whether, he says, the Gospels testify to the resurrection, but there's no non-Christian testimony to it, what proof do we have of the resurrection?
Yeah, so this is actually something I've done a big study on, and unfortunately, I can't, you know, take the rest of the show to do a central info core dump about the resurrection on the air. But I'll do what I can, and then I'll have a recommendation of some further resources and reading for Jeff. One of the things – and I like the fact he's talking about the resurrection because of all the miracles of Jesus, this is the one that you can really argue that this really happened on historical grounds. Others, Jeff's right. You do have to take them on faith. Mm-hmm. But this one is one where the alternative explanations can be eliminated, and as Sherlock Holmes says, When you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Mm-hmm. And so if you can show all of the other alternatives to the resurrection don't work, then you end up with strong evidence for the resurrection itself. So let's deal first with the particular passage he mentions. It's at the end of the Gospel of Mark, and the Jesus has repeatedly in Mark predicted that he's going to die and rise again. Happens three or four times in Mark, depending on how you count them. And he's also told the disciples that they need to meet him in Galilee after he's been raised. And then he's crucified and he's buried, and Mark makes a point of telling us the same women who saw him die saw him buried and then went back to the tomb to tend to his body. And so this is the chain of custody. Mark names these women, which is the only time it happens in Mark's gospel that you get a group of women named like this. So he's deliberately establishing the provenance of these witnesses. And then they encounter angels at the tomb, and they're told to go and tell the apostles, and they're reminded that Jesus has said that he's going to go before them to see them in Galilee, and they need to tell the apostles to go there, and they'll encounter Jesus. And then the women who have just encountered this angel and found the tomb empty are, you know, they're freaking out, and so they flee in terror, and it says, and they didn't say anything to anybody. The end of Mark as it appears in the oldest manuscripts. But there's a big question here about this, because if you keep reading in, let's say, the King James Bible or another traditional Bible, Mark doesn't stop here. It keeps going. There's another 12 verses where they do, in fact, go and talk to the disciples and let them know all this, and they encounter Jesus and so forth. Now, that longer ending, scholars today have concluded with a high degree of reliability, is not the original ending. It's something that got added later. And the question then is, well, why does Mark's gospel end in this way? And there are basically two big options. One of them is the original ending was simply lost, that at a very early stage of transmission, after Mark had been written, well, I'll mention a third. One of them is that the original ending is lost, that at a very early age, when one of the first copies was being copied, a page got torn off, or someone spilled water on it and it destroyed the writing or something, and the scribes weren't able to reproduce the last 12 verses. Mm-hmm. And so they just reproduced what they had, and that became the common version. But people noticed, wow, it's just so weird to stop right there.
Yeah, they just run off and nothing happens.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so later scribes then composed the last 12 verses based on primarily on material we find in the other Gospels, because you can tell it's recapitulating stuff from Luke and from John and so forth. It's possible then that one of the other Gospels, and in particular it's possible that Matthew, that most clearly resembles Mark, Matthew may have had access to the original ending of Mark. And you could then look at Matthew's ending to see what would have happened in Mark.
I see.
At least in outline form.
Right.
Now, another suggestion that's been proposed is that Mark wasn't able to finish for some reason, that he got up to a certain point and had to stop. Mm-hmm. And some emergency happened and he couldn't finish it and didn't want to hang up the release of the gospel. As possible, I don't think that one's likely. The third option that gets proposed is that Mark is being ultra super clever, and that because obviously the disciples have been reported for years by the time Mark is written, say in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
The disciples have been reporting for years that they saw Jesus. I mean, we have Paul's epistles like 1 Corinthians, where in 1 Corinthians 15, he's got this whole list of people who saw the risen Christ, including 500 or more.
Yeah.
And he says most of them are still alive. Go check them out. So these reports of the disciples encountering Christ in risen form have been around for a long time. Why doesn't Mark mention any? Well, some modern critics, scholars, think that Mark is just being ultra super clever, because he ends on this note where the women have been told to go proclaim Christ. And that's when he cuts it off and he's kind of throwing it over to the audience and saying, so what are you going to do with the message of the risen Christ?
Right.
He's kind of like daring the audience to go proclaim Christ. Possible, you know, that's possible that that's what's happening. I'm somewhat skeptical of that for a reason that's not obvious in English. In Greek, there are certain words that are used in – the fancy word for them is they're postpositive. And that means you don't use them in the first position. And actually, let me reframe that. I want to come at it a little differently. The word that ends the Gospel of Mark in the shorter ending is the word gar. And it means for. For is not the word you expect to have at the end of a sentence.
I see.
And so if Mark really ended there, it's ending on a really ungrammatical note. And that suggests to me that there's probably some continuation that's meant to keep happening after the for. And so that suggests to me a lost ending, which at least that's my most probable theory of what happened is this is a lost ending. And in that case, if there is a lost ending, then the women did after that. I mean, all Mark means is they didn't tell anybody while they were fleeing in terror.
Yeah.
Until they got home and it was safe and they met the apostles and they told them.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you see happening in the other gospels. The women get home, they tell the apostles go encounter Jesus in one or another place, depending on which resurrection appearances the evangelists have chosen to include in their gospel. And all of that makes perfect sense. The idea that after all this buildup for the resurrection and go see Jesus in Galilee and an angel shows up and tells them to go tell the disciples to get ready to go see him in Galilee.
And then
the women never told anybody at all.
Right.
And Mark chooses to record that fact. Really? That's what we're expected to take away from this?
Yeah.
So that interpretation just doesn't make sense to my mind. I think it's – and it's not, as Jeff indicated, a contradiction. It's as illustrated by what would have happened or what we can infer happened or what even did happen in a longer original ending of Mark. It's not a contradiction. It's just Mark cuts off at this one point for whatever reason and doesn't give us the rest of the story in the surviving original version. So having said that, that clears away one, you know, objection.
Right.
But there are other questions that people have about these. I've written rather extensively. If you go to jimmyakin.com and type in resurrection, you'll find things I've written that talk about the resurrection appearances and how they integrate with each other. If you go to my book, A Daily Defense, I have a whole series of entries that deal with the resurrection of Christ. And I list the different alternatives, like, because if you don't accept the resurrection, you've got to have some alternative theory of what happened.
Right.
And there have been a bunch that have been proposed, like maybe they all collectively hallucinated.
Yeah.
Or maybe they just went to the wrong tomb, you know, or maybe Jesus didn't really die. He just swooned on the cross and then revived in the tomb.
Right.
Or maybe they were just a bunch of liars. Well, okay, so people have proposed these alternative explanations. What's the evidence for them? And it turns out you go through them all and it's pretty easy to knock down each one. Like wrong tomb, okay?
Yeah.
Well, then why didn't the Jewish authorities go to the right one and produce the body?
Yeah.
You know, and
that's kind of like a Keystone Cops explanation.
Exactly. And the wrong tomb, if that's all that's happening,
is
the wrong, and they went to the wrong tomb, that doesn't explain why they saw him alive.
Right.
Or why they saw him ascend into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So the wrong tomb hypothesis is clearly inadequate. Okay, what about the swoon hypothesis? He just passed out on the cross. They thought he was dead. They buried him, and then he wakes up in the tomb once he has a chance to heal a little bit. Great. Okay, as an explanation, that could explain why the tomb was empty. Somehow maybe he got out of the tomb, you know, once he revived. And it could explain why they saw him alive. It would not explain why they saw him fly off into heaven. So, you know, that's not going to be an adequate explanation either.
Right.
And you go through all of
these. What about he had a twin brother explanation? Somebody actually proposed that.
Oh, yeah,
at some
point. The twin theory has several problems. Number one, twins are extremely rare. Yeah. I mean, it's like one – I mean, identical twins is like one in a thousand or something. And so it's very rare and it's notable when it happens. If you have a twin, people know about it.
Right.
So the disciples, if they saw someone that looks like Jesus after the after his crucifixion, would have said, could this be the twin?
Right, right.
And then, you know, I don't know, unless you're from the DC universe, most twins can't fly.
Yeah, I've noticed that. It's not one of the qualities of twinship.
Exactly. And there's a bunch of reasons there. And in A Daily Defense, I go through those and show why it ends up being actually the most reasonable hypothesis is Jesus did rise from the dead. It's not simply a matter of faith. It's something we have historical evidence for. And I'm not the only one who's written on this. There have been a bunch of books about this. You could also check out the Handbook of Catholic Apologetics by Peter Kreeft and Ronald Ticelli. You could check out The Resurrection Factor by Josh McDowell. You could check out Who Moved the Stone by Morrison. There have been lots of people who've written on this theme.
Jeff, that was pretty comprehensive. It was a very serious question, though, so I think it did deserve the time to give a comprehensive answer. We appreciate the question, Jeff, but we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here with a couple of very special offers for all of you interested in standing up for the rights of the unborn. January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and my DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 each. That's a saving of over 70%. I wrote this book and I made this DVD specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue and give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, or my DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Whatever I have learned, writes Catholic Answers founder Carl Keating, I have learned from the masters of the craft. In his new book, Booked for Life, a bibliographic memoir of an accidental apologist, Carl gives future generations a roadmap of what it takes and what it means to become a Catholic apologist. In the way only Carl can, he recounts numerous real-life situations he has encountered in his long career that illustrate the apologetic lessons he's learned. Then, drawing on a lifetime of experience, Carl reveals the books that helped him learn to defend the Catholic faith. Order your copy of Booked for Life today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Open Forum is our method today. So any question you have on the Catholic faith is welcome. Let's try to work through quickly some of these questions to get to everyone's if we can. Let's go to Jerry in Minnesota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Jerry, you are on with Jimmy Akin. No. Jerry's not there, so we will have to move to Alex in San. Jerry, call back. Sometimes it's me, Jerry. Sometimes it's not you. Alex in San Antonio, Texas, listening.
Don't break
EWTN.
Up with a caller like that.
I think maybe Jerry's going to call back. Alex, you there with us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can. Yeah, your question for Jimmy.
Okay, cool. So my question is just, what is your general opinion on the documentary hypothesis?
Okay. You're referring to the documentary hypothesis as applied to the Pentateuch, right? The first five books of the Bible?
Yes.
Okay. So for people who may not be aware of what that is, the documentary hypothesis is a view – it's proposed it started to be proposed a few hundred years ago, and it was really popular in the 20th century. The basic view is this. If you read the first five books of the Bible – Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, you can identify certain sources that they're based on. And according to the documentary hypothesis, there are four major sources, and they're known by the initials J, E, D, and P. The J stands for Yahwist, and the characteristic of the Yahwist source is that it uses the name Yahweh for God. E stands for Elohist, and its characteristic is that instead of referring to God as Yahweh, it refers to him as Elohim, which is one of the Hebrew words for God. And D stands for Deuteronomist, and that's basically the book of Deuteronomy. And then the last one, P, stands for priestly, and the idea is that one of the sources was written by someone or some group of people connected with the Jewish temple who were priestly individuals, and their priestly interests are reflected in what they wrote about and in the way they write. So like, for example, all of the religious regulations in Leviticus, a lot of them are going to be based allegedly on the priestly source. And so by looking for the different characteristics of these sources, you're supposed to be able to identify which one of the four major documents is being used at any given time in one of these books. Now, in principle, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, sure, lots of books in the Bible are based on previous sources, and sometimes they even tell us what those sources are. Other times, we can figure it out. And so, in principle, there's nothing wrong with the idea that that the Pentateuch is based on these four sources. It was a popular idea in the 20th century, is even accepted by individuals like John Paul II. If you read his early audiences, he talks about, you know, the Yahwist source and the Elohist source and so forth. Having said that, it's not a matter of church teaching. This is a scholarly theory, not a point of doctrine. And in recent years, it's started to wane in popularity. There have been more recent scholars who've said, you know, there are just some problems with this theory. And some of them have tried to reconfigure it by, for example, saying, okay, we don't have good evidence for the Elohist source, so E is looking shaky, but we still think these others work, and maybe we can carve up that Elohist material in some other way. And so they'll propose modifications of the classic four-source theory. But other scholars have gone farther, and frankly, this is the camp that I tend to fall into. I think there were sources to the Pentateuch, but I don't think that this theory correctly identifies them. A scholar – and I can recommend a couple of resources. One of them is a book called Before Abraham Was by Kikawada, K-I-K-A-W-A-D-A. And Quinn, Q-U-I-N-N. There are a couple of Protestant scholars, and they make a really good case that there are problems with this view. Another scholar I would point to in particular is a Jewish scholar named Gary Rendsburg, R-E-N-D-S-B-E-R-G. I think it might be U-R-G. But Gary Rendsburg is a very good Jewish scholar and has done a lot of work on the structure of Genesis, which is one of the sources where, unlike Deuteronomy, which is all thought to come from the Deuteronomist, in Genesis you're supposed to see this mix of stuff from the different sources. And you can show that if you pay careful attention to detail, it really does not look like that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. It looks like Genesis is structured according to other criteria. And like, for example, the flood narrative. You can show the flood narrative is a massive chiasmus. A chiasmus is a literary structure that is kind of like a pyramid. If you have – you can hear it in short ones, like Jesus is saying the first will be last and the last will be first.
Yes.
So you have – at the beginning and end of that, you have first and in the middle you have last. And you can structure it like a pyramid where it goes A, B, B, A. Mm-hmm. So you're like you're going up one side of the pyramid and then it inverts and you step down the other side. Well, it turns out if you look at the flood narrative, which goes on for three chapters, it's a gigantic chiasmus. But according to the four source theory, it's stitched together from two different sources. And nobody in the ancient world would stitch together two different sources to make it a giant chiasmus.
Yeah.
With all of these different elements, it would be impossible to do. And so that's something that Kikawada and Quinn point out. Rendsburg takes that and builds on it. And he has – actually, if you want his – he's got a lecture series on Genesis that's put out by The Great Courses, which I highly recommend. It's a really good lecture series. But if you want to see what he specifically says about Genesis, he's got a book called The Redaction of Genesis.
Okay.
Redaction is the process of editing. And so it's called The Redaction of Genesis. It's a very short book, but he goes into all this and shows you structurally how Genesis is put together, not from these sources, but how it's organized according to some very specific criteria that are clear once you start reading the text very carefully. So I'd recommend that. Also, I have an article that I wrote on Catholic Answers magazine a few years ago. And so if you search Jimmy Akin documentary hypothesis, you're likely to find some stuff either at my personal website or in Catholic Answers magazine.
Alex, thank you very much for the call. And just to be clear, for those who might have some concern about it, when you talk about the documentary hypothesis and you also talk about the fact that many sources come together to make scripture, including the Pentateuch, the Catholic view would be that this doesn't mitigate against these being inspired works at all.
It's all inspired.
They're human inspired work. Yeah. That is, God works through human beings.
Inspired doesn't mean God telepathically dictated it to you. It means God guided you and used you as an instrument as you used your various human faculties, including previous sources. So, you know, like when John is writing his gospel, he's relying on his memory of the events. Or Luke, you know, he tells us right at the beginning, I've made a careful study the material that was given to us by the eyewitnesses and ministers of the word.
Yeah.
So he tells us two kinds of sources he's using, eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. We can also tell based on various factors that he's using the Gospel of Mark.
Yeah.
So it's just one inspired document quoting another.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Let's see if we can – this will have to be quick just because we're limited on time. So Alex in San Antonio, Texas, listening on EWTN, your question quickly for Jimmy Akin.
That was Alex.
I apologize. I must have meant Philip. Philip in Arizona, real quick.
Hey, Jimmy. So to be brief, I'm developing my Catholic library and I'm trying to find some good reading material on the history of the popes, you know, starting with Peter, then his successors and so on and so forth.
All right.
Well, one thing you could do is just use the Catholic Encyclopedia and read through them because they all have entries. You know, we have that at Catholic.com. It's also at newadvent.org. So if there's a particular pope and you want a particularly Catholic take on that pope, then you could go there. What I would suggest, though, you might want to do is get a book called The Oxford Dictionary of Popes. It's by J.N.D. Kelly, if I'm not misremembering. Kelly is actually an Anglican scholar, but he's fairly Catholic-friendly, and his take on individual popes is going to be fairly neutral. There will be exceptions here and there. But in terms of just getting a kind of a capsule summary of the significance of each pope, I would go to something like the Oxford Dictionary of Popes, and that would kind of give you a reasonable quick overview of all of the different popes. And then you can drill down, perhaps using the Catholic Encyclopedia or another resource, to find out more about particular popes.
Okay, Philip?
That sounds good. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Jimmy's going to hang around for a while after the show, and we will remain on Facebook, YouTube, Periscope. So if you have questions and you'd like to ask them there, if you'd like to just say hello on Facebook, Periscope, or YouTube, please do. I can tell you, Jimmy, a question got asked on Facebook, and it's going to be my first question to you. And we talked about the L.
Right.
Michael, Daniel. Mm-hmm. I mean, did the people who created the Superman cartoons – intentionally choose Jor-El and Kal-El.
Actually, there's an argument they did.
Oh, really?
Because Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were both American Jews,
okay,
and there are elements of the Superman story that appear to be modeled after that of Moses.
Oh, okay. We'll talk about that a little bit more after this. When we switch over to us exclusively on Facebook, YouTube, and Periscope. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Big Friday show. We're going to talk a little bit with Dr. Carrie Gress about beauty tomorrow. And not beauty in some great abstract sense, but how God wants us to have beauty in our everyday life and how it makes a difference in our faith life. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.